Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. The sudden death of Cardinal Pell has taken both the Catholic Church and the world by surprise. It was following what had been a successful routine hip replacement operation. And as we record this present conversation, his funeral has just taken place. And it seems fitting to borrow some of the tributes that were made to him by a large congregation made up of his admirers and friends. He was seen to be one of the most visible opponents of the dictatorship of woke relativism in Australian public life. He was a vigorous opponent of what St. John Paul II dubbed the culture of death, with its embrace of abortion and euthanasia. He was a robust and successful, intelligent opponent of the new atheists like Richard Dawkins. And he lived that selfless, compassionate life he invited others to take up. He once invited 30 homeless people to morning tea in his archiepiscopal residence. He went out into the streets once a month to eat with the homeless. And, unlike some celebrities, he didn't invite a camera crew. After being called to Rome by Pope Francis, Cardinal Pell made significant headway against the financial corruptions of the Holy See, as a man of his character and integrity could, thoroughly reforming the Vatican Bank until he voluntarily returned to Australia to face what the courts would ultimately decide were spurious criminal charges, but not before the mob had him falsely imprisoned. Cardinal Ray's homily at his funeral described him as characterised by deep faith and great steadfastness of doctrine, which he always defended without hesitation and with courage, concerned only with being faithful to Christ. When he himself was burying a friend of his, Cardinal Pell said, "We are told that the sure mark of a false prophet is that all people speak well of him. In death as in life, this friend of ours has triumphantly escaped such a fate." And the same could be said for George Pell himself. It seems likely that the anti-Pell calumnies will multiply as the proponents of Catholic light wrestle with two documents that will fairly or not be regarded as his last testament. The first, through what had been the anonymous authorship of a memo intended for his fellow cardinals as they assessed the present pontificate and made judgments as to how to rescue the Church from what's gone wrong. And the second, a critique of the synodal process, especially the notorious working document for the continental phase of the synod, which he has called the toxic nightmare, and one that represented an outpouring of New Age goodwill that is hostile in significant ways to the apostolic tradition and nowhere acknowledges the New Testament as the Word of God, normative for all faith and morals. Edward Pentin, the full-time Rome correspondent for the National Catholic Register and a contributor to EWTN programmes, knew Cardinal Pell well. Edward's written for a variety of publications, Newsweek, The Sunday Times, Foreign Affairs, the National Catholic Register, and appeared on a wide variety of programmes, Al Jazeera, Sky News, CNN, Fox, ITV, BBC Radio 4, The World Tonight and The World Service. I asked Edward if he would share some of his own memories, his perspectives and his judgment following Cardinal Pell's death. And Edward joins me now. Edward, it's a great joy to meet you in person, and thank you so much for joining us on this podcast. It's very kind of you, because I badly needed someone authoritative to talk to about Cardinal Pell and his death, and you're just that person. How long had you been in Rome as a correspondent before you have taken up your present trajectory?
Well, I've been there 20 years now, so a long time. It's been a very interesting 20 years, lots of changes. And Cardinal Pell, I knew, I think, really quite well for the last 10 years, I'd say, ever since he was in charge, or took a leading role in the translation, the new translation of the liturgy, because he was part of that group that devised the new translation. So I've known him quite some time, yeah.
Well, it's marvellous that you're here and able to share some of your memories. My sense is that his death is a very important watershed in the life of the Church, certainly in the life of this papacy, but probably in at the beginning of the 21st century. And I hope we'll talk a little bit about that, though neither of us can foresee the future, but we have some sense of what the past has brought us to. And talking of the past, can I raise the issue of his initial conviction in Australia? Because I notice that as other people have been writing about him, those, I guess someone would say, the left is probably not the right term, but those who are deeply unsympathetic to him, or for good reasons, fired up by the injustices of sexual abuse, have been very quick to throw doubts on his pardon. But it struck me, both intuitively hearing, looking at him, sensing who he was and what he stood for, and then, of course, reading the evidence and watching the appalling trial, that there really wasn't a shadow of doubt about his innocence at all. Would you want just to reflect on that? I mean, do you share that view?
No, absolutely. And I, from the moment one heard about it and knowing the cardinal, it was just always considered, it was always incredulous to me. It was never something I thought was seriously true. And also the allegations were so wild. It just seemed completely unfeasible, really. I couldn't see it happened. And so, and I think that the turning point for me especially was when they released the video of his interrogation. They asked him about it straight on. They asked him, you know, about these allegations, and his reaction was so typical him, of just as you'd expect, if knowing him, if he was innocent, that's just the reaction he would have given. So yes, I always very sure that he was innocent, and it was nice to be able to put out articles and, you know, in my own small way, try to help him in that way, to bring to others the clear innocence he had regarding these allegations.
It makes the prison diaries all the more poignant, and I think we can understand how public opinion got whipped up in that way, in a disastrous way, looking, of course, for a scapegoat. And in that sense, the Catholic Church more generally must take some responsibility for the fact that it hasn't held perpetrators to account, and therefore there was some scope for the public being angry and wanting somebody to pay the price. One can understand that.
Yes.
But it shouldn't have been Pell, and he was innocent. I've got questions about the timing of the way in which the accusations were brought. And like anybody else, I'm very wary about conspiracy theories. Mm. they're not very good for one's sanity or indeed for one's professional reputation. No, but I can't rid myself of the sense that the timing was too convenient, it was too congruent. Here he goes in to cleanse your JN stables, where at least in my lifetime, it goes back to somebody hanging under Blackfriars Bridge. It's been a long time that the finances of the Vatican have been less than straightforward.
Yes.
And suddenly at this moment, the one man who might have had the strength of will and clarity of vision and moral probity to do it gets arrested on what is a false charge. How did you react to that?
Yes, I mean, ever since that happened, I mean, the timing, as you say, was very clear, and he was obviously making some real inroads into cleaning up the finances. And also the timing that the Auditor General Libero Maloney, his office was raided just a week before he was Cardinal Pell decided to go back to Australia to face these charges. And so the two together did raise suspicions very much. Yes. And I know from talking to people within the Vatican, in Vatican finances, that this was something that was discussed. In fact, I was talking to somebody, and I've tried to find evidence for this, but one of the lay people involved in Vatican finances, who's now being indicted, once said, you know, well, we can always get Cardinal Pell out of Rome by trumping up sexual abuse charges in Australia. And that happened only a few months later. So there are these questions. I did tell the Cardinal that, but there's no proof of that. But it does sound very feasible that there was some sort of plot orchestrated to get him out, because he was making so much progress in cleaning up the finances. But, you know, as you say, it's all speculation. It is rather still on the conspiratorial level. We have nothing really of evidence to prove it. It's all too coincidental in a way.
And large sums of money went from Rome to Australia that haven't been accounted for, might constitute the greasing of a wheel of some kind.
Yes.
But I mean, you know, once again, it's coincidence, and there's no evidence. But for those of us who are convinced of Pell's probity and profoundly attractive personal morality, it's hard not to think that this may constitute evidence of some malfeasance of some kind.
Indeed, yes. No, and there is these sort of paper. There are a few paper trails of money going to Australia, and I believe they went to, amongst others, the media. And the media was so against him. He was given no real in Australia especially, not given any real benefit of the doubt. It does seem as though they seem to have been paid off in some way. But again, it's so hard to get evidence. So there's the other connection, of course, was the mafia. There's a strong mafia link between the Calabrian mafia and the Calabrian mafia in Australia. And then there was talk of perhaps them being hired to do this. Perhaps one day we'll get the truth.
Let's get some reminiscences, because you actually knew him. I remember not exactly falling in love with him, but falling in profound like and admiration with him when I saw him debating Richard Dawkins in a debate. And I once encountered Dawkins and challenged him to a debate at the university I worked at, and he'd come to give out some degrees, and he appeared to me to run away. He wasn't very keen on debating intellectuals who were on top of their subject. He preferred to make fun of rather more rural Christians in some of his stuff. So I was fascinated to see Pell deal with him, and it was wonderful. It was this marvelous moment when Dawkins went down a rabbit hole to try and explain what the nothingness that he was proposing creation had emerged from was constituted by. And as he got in deeper and deeper, Pell and the audience laughed, and Dawkins looked up completely at a loss. What are you laughing at? Pell said, this wonderful phrase, well, you seem to be going at great lengths to describe nothing.
Yes, that's right.
It was just wonderful. Another moment when he claimed that Darwin was a theist, and Dawkins said, well, absolute nonsense. And Pell said, well, actually, it's on page 92 of his biography, near the bottom of the right-hand side of the page. tell me about something, but you knew him. I was a voyeur on the internet. Tell us some of your memories of him as a human being.
Well, yes. I mean, he was famous, of course, for being straightforward and that sort of typical Australian, bluntness, but great, because he cut through a lot of the platitudes and so forth that one often hears in church circles, especially these days. And he was like an old preacher who was just cuts to the chase and will call a spade a spade, and wouldn't suffer fools gladly, and wanted you to be accurate and have all your facts straight before you say anything to him and that kind of thing. But it was good. It was he was a very, as you say, a man of integrity, somebody who also had a great compassion for people. And I've known over the years people he would, ring up who he didn't know that well, perhaps an Australian, and give advice and pastoral advice, who they were going through a difficult time. And I remember that particular person said to me, he has a beautiful soul, and somebody who really did care for the individual and was willing to be very pastoral to them. So all this talk about him being, dogmatic, and basically insinuating that because he was orthodox, he wasn't compassionate. And as it often happens, people often try to make that assumption. He was quite the opposite. And he was very, very compassionate and just a very good pastor. And somebody who really, as we know, was a great defender of the faith. And not only was he physically tall, which helped, and a really big frame of a man, which helped, but he was willing to put his neck out and be courageous. And I think this is what also Pope Francis liked about him, funny enough. I heard that he really liked that honesty and straightforwardness of Cardinal Pell, because what he hates most, as I think most of us do, is that sort of not being totally honest with somebody and then not being forthright. And he was always honest with the Cardinal. And I understand that he did write to him on numerous occasions with concerns about the direction of the pontificate and so forth. He was not afraid to say these things.
There was a lovely moment I think he was the second interviewee of this podcast. And although we had a lot of trouble with the recording mechanisms, and it was done in the end on his iPhone held up by his chaplain. Very kind of him. So the quality was not of the best, but I loved the way in which he said he fully expected that the Holy Father would do certain virtuous things. And then he explained what those virtuous things he expected the Holy Father to do. I don't think the Holy Father has yet done them, but it was a kind of kind way of bringing pressure to bear of a moral kind, saying, this is what we would hope and expect from our Father, the Pope, and therefore, let it be heard. Yes. So he was clearly somebody who had views on how the papacy was going and what the issues ought to be, but very grown up and very delicate about the way in which he brought any moral pressure to bear. Do you think he was working behind the scenes in, well, I think what we have to describe as fairly chaotic atmosphere, full of political tectonic plates shifting? I mean, you can just, you're fresh from Rome, you'll have the words to describe it, but it's not an easy atmosphere, is it? Was he, however you describe the atmosphere, was he bringing pressure to bear to steer things in a different direction, to make representations for parts of the church that are having difficulty?
No, definitely. It was interesting. There was a change in him, because when he was prefect for the Secretariat for the Economy, he was obviously as part of the curial machine and as a member of the Council of Cardinals, which were advising Pope Francis on reforming the church. He was very careful to be loyal and to be seen to be loyal to the Pope. And he always was. I think any criticism of the pontificate and the Pope was primarily because he was a loyal son of the church and he wanted the good of the church. And that was, it wasn't in any way disloyalty in that respect. But after he came back from being released and came back to Rome, he took a distinctly more critical view of the current pontificate. And I think his eyes were opened somehow into just how serious the crisis is. And he was willing to make representations, as you say. And he was, I did write to him only a couple of months ago, or 2 or 3 months ago. And I just asked him how, you know, our cardinals, our various heads of the church, expressing their concerns about the current direction. And I looked at the example of, and gave him the example of Pope Leo X during Martin Luther's time. And I hadn't realized just how much Pope Leo had tried and pleaded with Martin Luther to change his course, and actually invited him to Rome, where they were going to pay him to come to Rome to change his mind and so forth. And he rejected all those things. And I just said to him, have the cardinals done this too? And he rang me up. He was on his way to somewhere. And he said, Ed, I just have two words to say to you many times. He said, so many times they've been trying to explain to him behind the scenes. And I've heard this from other cardinals too, their concerns about the direction of the pontificate.
One of the reasons that that's reassuring is because all of us, of course, are concerned about what happens at the next conclave. On the one hand, we know that the majority of cardinals have been appointed by Pope Francis. And on the other hand, we know they don't know each other, and there isn't a sense of coherent communication and analysis. So what that means is that nobody knows what's going to happen. But what you're suggesting is that there is a level of concern within the cardinals about the direction that the present pontificate has taken. And one might hope, and perhaps it's a proper thermostatic control, one might hope that the thin pope, fat pope principle comes into operation. So for those of us who want to be optimistic as well as hopeful, you're suggesting that Pell's concern was more widely shared.
Yes, and in fact, that's something that he said, that I think he said that the College of Cardinals was becoming, that many of them were becoming more concerned about the direction. And he was hopeful. He was hopeful that the path could be changed, that we could get back, as he said in that memo, that to a more Christocentric church, something more based upon the gospel and sound doctrine, especially, and clarity of doctrine. That was a key thing for him, was clarity of doctrine. Yeah.
Let's talk about that. So, but before we do, speaking as every man, steeped in a certain amount of every man's ignorance, what's happened to the finance? So, I mean, first of all, credit to Pope Francis. He chose the right man to take on the financial incoherence and lack of accountability. Pell then, for whatever reason, was removed. What's happened since? I mean, so the job that Pell set out to do, has it stalled? Is it still being taken seriously? There's still a scandal that has to be sorted out. And presumably, once Pell went back to Rome, he must have experienced some interest in whatever his successors were doing. Do you know anything at all about how that particular scandal is progressing or being dealt with?
The scandal is still going on, the trial of the London property scandal. But more generally, and that's really a bit of a side issue, because the as you say, I think that there have been some considerable reforms. And Cardinal Pell was pleased after he came back that Francis had put in new sort of systems to centralize the Vatican finances, which was something that Cardinal Pell had proposed when he was prefect. I think he was very optimistic about it in that sense, and pleased with the progress that had been made by Francis. What he did say, and what those in Vatican finances were concerned about was that all of the good measures that they put in, but from 2014 to 2016, let's say, and that the Pope agreed to, the Pope then undid and basically reversed them. And we don't know why. It was a strange thing because, you know, there's great progress that had been made in those first 2 or 3 years. And then when Cardinal Pell, of course, went back to Australia, a lot of it was also undone. I don't think it was connected to his return to Rome. But once he was released, a lot of the measures that he'd wanted were put into place. So yeah, there has been a rather odd sort of path, but there has been improvement in that score, yeah.
Well, that's very encouraging. I mean, as you say, it's a side issue, an important side issue, and it reflects on the integrity both of the church and of the papacy and of the Vatican. So it's very good to know that it's taken that particular turn. Let's go to the memo. I was listening to some traditionalist Catholics on the media proclaiming with glee that this was obviously, you know, everyone now knew it was Cardinal Pell who had authored it. And I must say, it certainly lines up with some of his concerns. But once again, one's concerned not to jump too quickly to the conspiratorial, the Dan Brown-esque solution. Yeah. But you know Pell, you know what he's been saying, you've talked to him firsthand, you've read the memo and sat with it for a while. Was Demos Pell?
Well, my interpretation of it is yes, because if not directly, then certainly he had a hand in it. Because as I put in this article we published at the Register yesterday, there's a lot in there which we know that he was concerned about, because he's actually said so publicly. So there's so much coherence there with what he was also saying, also privately, but a lot publicly. For example, the huge deficits in the Vatican, the parlous state of Vatican finances, which remain despite the reforms. You know, he was very concerned about the pension fund, which is 800 million euros by 2030. He was always concerned about that and saying it publicly. And then the other big thing for him was the lawlessness in the Vatican that's developed under Pope Francis. That was particularly concerning to him, especially because of his own experience of injustice. So yeah, he was very concerned about those, and that's reflected in the memo, and also the whole tone of it, and the sort of sardonic wit of Cardinal Pell was very clear too.
You can't you can't disguise dry Australian sardonic wit. It is what it is.
It is, and it was also very straightforward. You know, it was very blunt and to the point. And I mean, I don't think it's too much to say, but I think this is probably one of the, if not the most important document of the pontificate, because I think it sums up all of the problems, but also gives a lot of hope of what can be done to reform it, and looking towards the next conclave as well, and who could be the right person to put these changes into place. Particularly, is another concern of his, of course, was, as I said earlier, clarity of doctrine, and he wanted that. You know, he's very clear about the need for good teaching, and to bring back good teaching, and put Christ at the center. That the Christ at the center of the church, and of course that's what should always be the case.
I think there's something of, I mean, you described him as a very straightforward, large, clever Australian, and there's something about his straightforwardness which to me felt antidotal to the ambiguity that has defined the last few years, and it was hugely welcome. And so let us assume for the moment that Demos is Cardinal Pell. The implications of this invitation to become more Christocentric in the church, I mean, they're very welcome. And is that going to provide some kind of rallying cry? It's very hard to criticize the direction that the church is going in, because it's experimental. It's not, there are no sort of doctrinal tags you can attach to it. It's not, you know, it's not liberation theology. It's not obviously only progressive. It's a mixture of some things that appear pastorally quite friendly, but carry with them levels of, on the spectrum, from incoherence at one end to immorality at the other end. It's very difficult. It's like a bar of soap in a bath, hard to grab and hard to describe. So if one can't describe what's going wrong, it was very refreshing to me that he was able to describe what should go right. I mean, is there a sense in Rome that whilst there'll be disagreements about what the problem is, the solution is more obvious in the way that Pell expressed it in that document?
Yes, I think so. I mean, if you talk to most practicing Catholics who are really trying to live according to the Church's teaching, I think they would agree with a lot of what's in this memo, especially with, you know, how to to bring things back to clarity of teaching. And I think, yeah, I think that's true. I think the most people would say that who took their faith very seriously. And not to say those who take their faith seriously don't always get it, but I think those who do would say that Cardinal Pell was a great ally in this fight for good, solid teaching. And to bring back this sense that, you know, just because you uphold the teachings of the church doesn't mean you lack compassion. It's quite the opposite. I think, as Benedict also said, and John Paul, that in order to be a good, compassionate Christian, you have to be also faithful to the church's teaching. Then the two go together. There's no dichotomy between the two, which is what we often hear today, that teaching has to be put aside in order to be merciful and compassionate. But it's the opposite. I think that was a great concern also of the cardinal, that those two go together.
Well, and we get that in the genuinely competent psychotherapeutic world. One of the things that is a given is that the boundaries have to be strong. You don't help people therapeutically right. with fuzzy boundaries. And sometimes, particularly in the sort of the Kleinian end of things, rigidity is exactly what provides a safe space for people to pursue the work of reintegration. So right. There's a kind of ignorant populist assumption that, well, it's being nice, isn't it? It's the religion of nice, which is so devastating and corrosive of real faith.
It reminds me of the Chesterton analogy of the children in the playground, that they cannot play unless they have gates around them in order to play safely. You know, it's a
yes, beautiful. No, that's. Yeah. That's wonderfully put. Exactly so. If we go on to synodality, which is going to cast a shadow over the next couple of years, his last will and testament, putting the boot in to it. I mean, he used some very powerful language of nightmare and toxicity. His analysis of the synodal way, the synodal process, was coruscating. Do you think that will have any influence? Will people sort of hold up his last speech and say, listen to the cardinal, he was right, you know, and therefore put the brakes on some of the, well, I mean, there's an American professor who's just said that simply in terms of the way in which you do consultations, this is an amateurish and highly unprofessional exercise, which can only have a bad outcome, just at the level of process, forgetting what content might be.
Yes.
So where are we in the politics of synodality?
Often one hears in Rome now that it's the whole synodal process, especially this particular one, is losing credibility day by day because of these criticisms, which many see as very valid. This whole opening up and listening is always seen and is, let's face it, it is one-sided. They're only listening to those who don't want to accept the church's teaching, particularly, especially on certain matters, but those who are willing to uphold tradition and the teachings of the church, the perennial teachings of the church, the magisterium, are not listened, or at least they're not taken as seriously as those who are trying to push the church along a more progressive path. So it's entered a certain crisis, I would say, the whole synodal process. And some are speculating whether it's actually going to be completed, especially, of course.
Oh, really?
If right. we get a new pope, one wonders if the whole process will be brought to a halt if we do get a new pope.
And do you think when you talk getting a new pope, are you talking about death or retirement? Because again, that's in terms of Rome gossip, that's right. another.
Yes,
that seems to be another emerging topic of conversation.
Is. I mean, it's all very speculative, of course. Yes, I think it's unlikely Francis will resign. I think that's generally the consensus. I don't think he's, unless he were to become completely incapacitated, I don't think he would. But then his health is not good either, and he's undergoing quite a lot of treatment, and it's not just his knee. We believe there's something more. Of course, he had this operation on his intestine last year of 2021, and that was actually much more serious than they were expecting, so we'll see what happens. But yes, it is quite conceivable that we'll get a new pope, you know, within a few years. He is, after all, 86 now. So, yeah, we'll have to see what happens.
We're coming to the end, I think. Do you have any a last recollection of Cardinal Pell that you particularly enjoy in the light of his death as a testimony to who he was and what he might mean for the church?
Well, just that he was such a great breath of fresh air, and his good humor, of course, was great in getting through these difficult times for the church. He was somebody who we really needed at the time, I think, for those who were struggling with the current direction of the church. And he was a real brick, you know, of a pillar who was very helpful to people. And of course, going through all of that experience in prison and an example he gave was tremendous. And he was a very matter of fact sort of person. I remember asking him, you know, when the crowds were jeering at him, you know, what were you, you know, and he was very philosophical about the whole thing and was, you know, took the whole time in prison as a kind of long retreat, which he felt. But yeah, he was just willing to put up with a lot and suffer in accordance with the church's belief and just offered everything up and was a great witness to us all, I think.
It's very encouraging when you find somebody that you can easily admire because they're you know, they're clever, they're morally substantial, they're WYSIWYG. What you see is what you get.
Yeah.
To have somebody like that love God with a strong, stable passion is an inspiration to some of us lesser mortals. I was particularly touched by what I've read of the prison diaries because, you know, one has, you know, we're all good. We're all going to have to suffer for our faith. We all do suffer from our faith.
Mm.
But that was fairly intense, both symbolically and existentially, to be called a paedophile and then to be imprisoned was, I think, imposed a burden that many lesser men like me would have found very difficult indeed to survive.
And then, of course, won over his fellow inmates who clapped him and gave him applause when he was released. So that was,
I didn't know that, really.
Yes, yes.
So what happened?
Yes, because often, you know, accused paedophiles who end up in
jail, not popular in prison.
They're not popular at all. But he won them over and wrote letters to them and sent messages and very, very popular with them, yeah. Yeah.
Well, let that be the final tribute to a wonderful man. Edward, thank you so much for taking the time and trouble to do this. My dog is telling me that she thinks we've gone on long enough. Oh, well, no, one last thing, which we were going to mention, because we may use it as a bridge to a further conversation of a podcast. You and I were educated at the same school and grew up in the same part of the country and have a love for Canterbury Cathedral. Just before you go, this rumour that Cardinal Pell may have celebrated Mass there for the first time since Cardinal Pole at Canterbury Cathedral. Can you say whether or not it happened? Do you know any more about the rumour? And we might link it to Pope Benedict in Westminster Abbey.
Yes, well, I'm still trying to get confirmation about this, but certainly in 2016, it was announced that he was going to celebrate Mass at the high altar of Canterbury Cathedral. And if he had, he would have become the first Catholic cardinal to have celebrated Mass there since Cardinal Pole in the 16th century, who was Cardinal Reginald Pole. So that would have been very historic. I think it did happen, but there's not much on the web to confirm it. So I'm trying to get confirmation from those who would know. But incredibly
wonderful. Historic. Well, I was confirmed as an Anglican on the high altar and
so was I.
Cathedral. So were you. Wonderful. Well, how marvellous that Cardinal Pell, we hope, did celebrate it for the first time since Pole, and that it matters so much to you and I. And of course, I mean, I was also deeply moved by when Pope Benedict sat in Westminster Abbey again, the first cardinal since Pole. So perhaps it's a sign of the way that the Kingdom of Heaven is moving and what his intentions are for the Catholic Church and
in England.
It's healing and restitution in England, yes.
God willing, yes.
Yeah, indeed. Well, thank you so much. Bless you. We're very grateful for the conversation.
My pleasure. Thank you.